Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, podcast listeners. Great show tonight. Amazing doctor, Paul Offit, who talks to us about this huge crisis of measles erupting in the United States, mostly because of the anti-vax movement and not wanting to vaccinate their kids. But in the rest of the world, it's because of poverty and also because of lack of access. There's a 300% jump in measles-related deaths. Then we talk to this amazing comedian couple, Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney, whose fourth and final season of the TV hit comedy Catastrophe is now available on Amazon. It's truly an amazing show that has hit the nerve with everybody who's interested in relationships, marriage, and parenthood. And finally, Alicia Menendez talks to first-time director Nia DaCosta about a film that's centered on women and poverty and why she wants people to know what that does. So enjoy the show. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. We live in a world where facts are under fire, whether it's the peril of fake news, the rise of climate denialism, or even the war against vaccinations. Vaccines are a miracle that have saved people from illnesses that have plagued humanity for centuries. Now, young lives are at risk again, as the highly infectious disease measles makes a deadly return. The World Health Organization says it still kills 100,000 people a year. And so far, in 2019, infections are up 300% compared to this time last year. While a lot of this is due to limited access to healthcare in poorer countries, we're also seeing the anti-vax movement and measles surging in richer nations, where people are turning away from vaccines because of false information that's spreading even faster than the illness. And the consequences are life-threatening. Just today, we learned that an Israeli flight attendant has gone into a measles-induced coma, while the mayor of New York has declared a health emergency after hundreds of fresh cases. Pediatrician and research professor Dr. Paul Offit joined me to talk about this crisis. He co-created a vaccine for rotavirus, which is a sickness that strikes young children. Dr. Paul Offit, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It is extraordinary to be talking to you sitting there in Washington, the United States of America, and talk about a resurgence of a disease, a virus that we thought had been eliminated, eradicated so long ago. Why is this happening?
Because people are choosing not to vaccinate their children. We eliminated measles from the United States by the year 2000. I think the problem is that some people have forgotten about the disease, and so they don't take it seriously, and as a consequence, they're not vaccinating their children. And so measles has come back, and so again, children have to suffer this disease, some of whom are hospitalized, some of whom are hospitalized in an intensive care unit. Really, it's unconscionable.
The CDC says that in about 20 U.S. states, there were about 555 measles cases reported since the beginning of this year. Why is it spreading?
It is the most contagious of the vaccine-preventable diseases. You don't even have to have face-to-face contact with someone who's sick. The virus is spread by small droplets. If I had measles sitting in this room and then left this room, anybody who came into this room within 2 hours of my being here could catch measles. That's why it's the most difficult of the vaccine-preventable diseases to eliminate. And that's why when immunization rates fray, it's invariably the first disease that comes back.
Tell us about exactly what it does to the body. Again, I had measles when I was a kid. I had mumps. I had all the basic diseases before there were these vaccines that we have now. Obviously, I've vaccinated my own kid. But what does measles do to you?
So measles virus enters usually via the upper respiratory tract, the nose, and then the throat, and then it spreads into the bloodstream, and then it goes elsewhere. It spreads to the lungs, and it causes pneumonia. It can spread to the brain and cause something called encephalitis. Sometimes it sets up for a secondary bacterial infection of the lungs, like with staph or strep. And occasionally it kills you. Before we had a measles vaccine in the United States in 1963, every year 3 to 4 million people would get measles. About 48,000 would be hospitalized and 500 would die. I think the problem is that we've forgotten about all that. And so as a consequence, we're condemned to relive it.
So the WHO says that it's a bit of a global crisis right now. Something like 100,000 deaths caused by measles, certainly, you know, a year for the last several. Can you track back how the epidemic, the outbreak, started in the United States? Because we understand that, for instance, in Rockland County, New York, we know that there's some Orthodox Jewish communities, also in Brooklyn, both areas that have seen an outbreak.
First of all, actually, from a worldwide standpoint, we're doing much better. We've gone from, you know, from 800,000, a million cases of measles a year, and I'm sorry, deaths from measles a year, down to now like 100,000. Actually, we're doing better from a worldwide perspective. However, you know, we haven't eliminated it from the world. International travel is common. And when people come from places like the Ukraine or come from Romania or come from Israel, you know, where measles is unfortunately endemic, then they can bring the virus here. And if there's enough of a pocket of people in areas of the United States that aren't vaccinated, then that serves as fertile ground for the virus to spread. That's what happened in Clark County, Washington State. That's what happened in Southern California. That's what's happening now among a very small group of ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities who are making that choice. Although, ironically, certainly this has nothing to do with the Jewish religion. And most people in those communities are vaccinated. Unfortunately, a critical number aren't.
I mean, dig down into that for us. Are there legitimate reasons, religious reasons, not to be vaccinated?
No. I think no. I think that if religions teach us anything, it's to care about our children, to care about our community, to care about our health. Certainly, there's nothing in the Jewish religion that says don't get vaccinated. I mean, the three major texts that that serve as for the Christian, Muslim, and Jewish faiths all were written well before 1796, was when the first vaccine was invented, the smallpox vaccine. And all those three major texts care deeply about health. So, no, I think that frankly, exposing your child to unnecessary harm and then therefore exposing those with whom your child comes in contact to unnecessary harm is a profoundly unreligious thing to do.
So just to figure out how now to reimpose what you all call the herd immunity. This is what the mayor of New York has said about the situation.
Today, we are declaring a public health emergency effective immediately. This will mandate vaccines for people living in the affected area. Department of Health will issue violations and fines to people who remain unvaccinated. The only way to stop this outbreak is to ensure that those who have not been vaccinated get the vaccine. It's crucial for people to understand the measles vaccine works. It is safe, it is effective, it is time tested.
So presumably as a doctor, you agree with that. But how does one enforce mandatory vaccinations if that's what he's suggesting?
Right. Well, there's actually a distinction between mandatory vaccination and compulsory vaccination. What Mayor de Blasio is arguing for is mandatory vaccination, which is to say he's asking citizens in those communities to be vaccinated. If they don't get vaccinated, then they may have to pay some sort of societal price, like a fine, for example. In Philadelphia in 1991, we had, in a several-month period, we had 1,400 cases of measles and 9 deaths that centered on two fundamentalist Christian churches that were faith healers, meaning they didn't believe not only in vaccines, they didn't believe in medical care. And so they served as the epicenter for that outbreak. We had compulsory vaccination, which is to say those parents by court order had to be vaccinated and did. And so I think Mayor de Blasio stuck in many ways. I mean, he wants to stand up for the health of those communities. And the only way to do that is to say you really need to be vaccinated because vaccines are safe and effective. When people in that community are making the decision not to be vaccinated, they're making it based on bad information. They have this misconception that the vaccine is dangerous when it's not. And so what do you do in situations like that? I think ultimately you have to, at times, compel people to do the right thing. I mean, we compel people to stop at stop signs. We compel people to sit in car seats or else they get a ticket, because it's the right thing to do. It's the safe thing to do. I feel sorry for Mayor de Blasio because he's in such a tough spot.
If you do try to force people who, for whatever reason, think a vaccine is dangerous, it may make them go further underground, so to speak.
Right, but what else can you do? I mean, the fact of the matter is they have this false concern that the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, is dangerous. It's not dangerous. I mean, they believe it might cause autism, which isn't true, or it might cause a variety of other chronic diseases like, you know, diabetes or multiple sclerosis or hyperactivity disorder, whatever. That's not true. So when people then are making that choice, what do you do? I mean, is it your inalienable right as a citizen to allow your child to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection? I think the answer is no. And I think what Mayor de Blasio is doing is standing up for those children. Now, might there be a backlash? There might be. But I think that the alternative, which is to allow that virus to continue to spread, allow that virus to continue to cause suffering and hospitalization and the possibility of death, is just too awful to imagine. And so he's stepping forward at a time, hopefully early enough, where that won't happen.
What happens if it goes undealt with, if it's not vaccinated?
I think we lived through the nightmare scenario in Philadelphia in 1991 when we had 1,400 cases and 9 children died. We were pretty slow to react to that. I mean, to essentially force people to be vaccinated, because I think when it comes to the law, we don't like to tell people how to raise their children. We certainly don't like to tell people how to practice their faith. But occasionally a line is crossed, and that's been true here, where you do have to stand up for those children. I mean, I think we always assume that parents are making the best decision for their children, but that's not always true. And in this example, it's not true here.
So talk to me then about the fact that mostly in the United States or other developed nations where we've seen this disease be eliminated in the past, it is mostly now a question of these hoaxes, this anti-vax movement. How dangerous has that been? Are we seeing, in other words, the chickens coming home to roost, and how dangerous could it continue to be?
Well, the World Health Organization now lists this so-called anti-vaccine movement as one of the top 10 global health threats. I mean, not only in the United States do we have these unfounded, unscientific fears, but we export those fears to other countries. And so you're seeing now, you know, other places also who adapt this sort of this notion that vaccines are causing harm when they're not. And now you're seeing, you know, vaccine preventable diseases come back at some level. You know, what's frustrating, I guess, for me as a doctor is that there's so much in medicine that we don't know. There's so much that we can't do. This we do know. Specific germs do cause specific diseases. There's ways that we can prevent them. And when you watch parents sort of turn their back on that, expose their children to unnecessary harm, it's very hard to watch. But invariably, it is the children who suffer our ignorance here.
Now, talk to me a little bit about people maybe of my generation or earlier who have been vaccinated as kids, but maybe didn't have multiple vaccinations and maybe didn't know that you have to keep updating them. We understand that an Israeli flight attendant has slipped into a coma now, having contracted measles. She might have encephalitis, and she had been vaccinated as a child.
Right. So vaccines, like any medical technology or technique, are not 100% effective. I mean, the measles vaccine, for example, one dose of measles vaccine confers about 92% to 93% protective efficacy. The second dose gets you up into the high 90% range. But like anything, it's not 100% effective. So when, for example, anti-vaccine people will say, what do you care what I do? I mean, you're vaccinated. That assumes vaccines are 100% effective, which isn't true. It also assumes that everyone can get a vaccine, which isn't true, because there are certainly hundreds of thousands of people in the United States who can't be vaccinated because they're getting cancer chemotherapy or they're getting immune suppressive therapy for their chronic diseases, or they're too young. So I think it's a selfish act, actually, to not just only put your child, but those with whom they come in contact at risk.
So let's just broaden this out a bit, because obviously this deliberate desire not to vaccinate your children is one thing. But in the rest of the world, it's often something else. As we've said, the WHO has identified this as a major problem. Apparently, the cases of measles around the world has increased 300%. Describe for me what's happening around the rest of the world, where it's not just deliberate, it's a major problem of access.
Right. So different cultures sort of determine different vaccine uptakes. In a number of African countries, for example, it's a matter of access. I mean, these are resource-poor countries that often don't have the access to vaccines or don't have the place to get the vaccine. And so groups like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are doing everything they can to try and make those vaccines available to those areas. But if you look, for example, in the Middle East, like United Arab Emirates or Qatar or Saudi Arabia, those vaccine rates are close to 100%. If you look at in Scandinavian countries like Sweden or Finland, vaccine rates are close to 100%, even though they're not mandated there. But yet in Western Europe, you know, measles is fairly endemic because vaccines aren't mandated and people choose not to vaccinate. So it does seem to be the culture determines whether one is likely to get a vaccine or not. But I think the hardest part, you're right, is that in those areas that are resource poor, where they don't have access to vaccines, I think groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are doing a yeoman's job at really getting death rates down in those countries.
You, again, are in the United States of America, where there is currently an assault on facts and evidence and science. I mean, the president himself has used the word, you know, he's sort of entertained this anti-vax, you know, movement to an extent. And science and evidence is being held up to question and ridicule. Beyond just measles, a person in your position, what do you think the country's in for next, whether it's in disease, this one or others?
Right. I think you're exactly right. I think we move sort of from scientific literacy into scientific denialism. People simply declare their own truths, even though they're wrong, like vaccines cause autism or creationism and evolution or equally valid hypotheses or climate change is a hoax. I mean, I think we will suffer that. I mean, we moved from, you know, the age of darkness into the age of enlightenment because of science. Because of science, we live 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago. To turn our backs on science, which I feel at some level we're doing, is something for which I fear we will pay an enormous price down the line.
Dr. Offit, if you could stare down the barrel of that camera and talk to the people in the communities which are not vaccinating their children, what would you say to them now, given what we know to be the case with these outbreaks and deaths?
A choice not to get a vaccine is not a risk-free choice. It's a choice to take a different and more serious risk. And we're starting to see what that risk looks like. Now you have over 250 people in New York who are suffering measles. We have 20 people who are hospitalized. We have 5 people in the intensive care unit. We are on the verge of watching people die of a completely preventable infection. Please, please vaccinate your children. Please don't put them at unnecessary risk. Please.
Dr. Paul Offit, thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that was the plea of a scientist and a doctor. And one of the other major crises is denialism over the scientific evidence of climate change. Protests continue the world over, trying to get governments to listen now. In London, the group Extinction Rebellion are continuing to close down some of the city's busiest roads. While in France this week, 16-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg made an emotional plea to the European Union to do something before it's too late.
Deforestation of our great forests, toxic air pollution, loss of insects and wildlife, the acidification of our oceans. These are all disastrous trends being accelerated by a way of life that we, here in our financially fortunate part of the world, see as our right to simply carry on.
She's only 16, and clearly it's a really hard burden for her, and she's emotional. But she continues. She's still at it. Today she met with her fellow climate activist, Pope Francis, in Vatican City. Now we turn to a different kind of catastrophe, if I may. Actually, I'm talking about the award-winning television comedy, getting major plaudits for its fun yet authentic take on marriage and parenthood, with a dash of nuance included. Here's a look at something many working parents of small children trying to take a vacation might recognize.
You should be able to handcuff your kids to the airplane seat. They'd be all, for like a minute, and then they'd be fine. Have a super trip to Vermont. I'll get trampled by a moose.
A monster.
I know. I mean, what was her problem? Frankie went up to her, what, like 2 or 3 times?
Yeah, she didn't want kids talking to her. She didn't want a f***ing Shrek jumper. Oh, my God, I need to stop for a second. I'm so tired I could cry.
Well,
put on your sunglasses and cry.
I can't. Wear and pop one of the lenses out.
Oh, honey.
Catastrophe is the brainchild of the Irish writer and actress Sharon Horgan and the American comedian Rob Delaney. The fourth and final season of the show has debuted on Amazon Prime, where once again is getting rave reviews from viewers and critics alike. And Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney join me now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I just want to say Sharon and I made sure to vaccinate each other before we went on air.
So. All right. Have you vaccinated your kids? That's what I want to know.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Of course. Yep. We're not insane.
Constantly.
Well, listen, you know that first clip that we just showed in the introduction, it just shows two parents dealing with the normal hurly-burly of everyday life, including, you know, trying to rein in your kid, Sharon, as you're just having a little sort of weak moment there, wanting to have a cry. Explain for us why this has taken off. Why do you think it has? We all know why we love it. But did you think it would, you know, hit such a funny bone, such a nerve?
Oh, no. I mean, we're delighted that it has, but I don't think we had any idea that it necessarily would. I think we just wanted to be very honest and paint a real picture of what it's like to keep a relationship going once you throw kids and, you know, all the other kind of catastrophes of life into the mix. And
I think if we did have a secret sauce for our show, it's that it is written by one man and one woman. So I think viewers can maybe smell that.
Yes, indeed. I want to get back to how you guys first met, right? Essentially on Twitter. I mean, you weren't dating. It wasn't a dating app, but you met on Twitter because of the professionalism and the humor. I mean, tell us how you actually met on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed now almost 10 years ago that Sharon followed me on Twitter, and she had created a sitcom a few years prior called Pulling, which was just the greatest sitcom I'd ever seen in my life. And so I wrote her and I said, thank you for following me on this silly website. and she wrote back, and then we became friendly. She came and saw me do stand-up, and then we would work together on little stuff. And then one day we just thought we might, you know, see if we could write a sitcom together.
So, yeah, I mean, that's sort of it in a nutshell. But I'd also, you know, from seeing Rob's stand-up, really loved how he talked about stuff and really loved how he talked about marriage in particularly. And so I think we sort of knew that it would work, you know, our styles together blended.
I mean, what were you trying to tell us all about marriage? Because, look, it is extraordinary and you do, you know, look like you're having sort of real life discussions. But you also, I mean, look, there's a lot of angst, there's a lot of humor, there's a lot of, you know, tears, there's a lot of laughter. But in the end, you don't really have massive rows. When one of you, you know, sort of kind of irritates the other one or, you know, gets them angry, it's not like you storm out and you never talk to each other again or have the big silence. You manage to have a mature response that perhaps a lot of couples may not have in the end. How did you come up with that?
I think we wanted to show that marriage is interesting. I think we felt a lot of sitcoms, not all of them, because of course there are great ones, but some of them sort of did marriage a disservice and kind of made it look like a slog, which marriage usually, it seems to me, is either you're like, you want to kill your spouse, and not in a funny way, like you're figuring out how do I kill them, and then you want to wipe the browser history so you don't get caught. I mean, you're really planning their death. Then 5 minutes later, you're like, you have you're wrapped around their ankles being like, I can't believe you let me kiss you ever. And so it's you rocket between those two poles. It's not like, you're not like, hey, she's driving me nuts, or like, nah, all he does is golf. That is ridiculous. No marriage is like that. It's those two poles.
Yeah.
And also we realized, I mean, when we put them in a difficult situation, when something terrible happened and they did argue or did sort of decide they weren't going to talk anymore, that's not very interesting on screen, yeah. Having two people, you know, just constantly shouting at each other or not communicating at all. So we would find ways for them to make each other laugh. And I think that is also a little bit of the secret sauce in it, is that they just really like each other's company better than anyone else in the world. And they like making each other laugh. It's their favorite thing.
Well, I mean, that's
it. It's kind of easy with those characters to go from, you know, crazy hate to laughter.
Well, I think you just kind of nutshelled it for me. They like each other's company better than anybody else in the world. And they like to make each other laugh, and they'll, you know, stick through the horrible stuff to get to the other side. And it's, again, extraordinary because this was essentially a one-night, one-week stand, right? I mean, Rob, in the show, you guys had a one-night, one-week stand, and you still, in series four, have her number in your cell phone as Sharon Sex London. Still, you know, after all that you've been through. Mm-hmm. And then...
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, we just would have been so sad. I mean, we thought about that, but then what happens? You know, 3 years into your marriage, you look at your wife's number and you're like, you know what? Why don't I just sand that down to just her name? Like the cute little thing from the beginning, you know, that's lovely. So I think, you know, not doing that is sort of one illustrative little nugget that, you know, is sort of a key to that relationship.
Yeah, but also it was like, you know, we're hungry for jokes.
Yeah.
And any time we could sort of just get an extra one, you know, whether it's just showing Sharon London sex or anything we can sort of repeat and get laughs from, we will.
Well, here's another clip, again, from this final season. And it's when Rob is coming home and there's going to be a work dinner with the boss and his wife, and you're telling Sharon about it.
We've been invited to a dinner with the big Brabant boss and his wife.
We've been invited? Me too?
Yes.
Oh, God, really? When? I hate work dinners.
You've never been to one. I've literally never once asked you to come to a work dinner.
What will they want from me?
I don't know. Your wife-like presence?
Yeah, but should I be chatty like Michelle Obama, or should I be more like Jackie Kennedy? You know, like, don't say much, but when I do say something, really make it count. Like, slag off the Queen.
I think I'm going to say you can't make it.
Aww.
I mean, I'm still laughing at that. The relationship, the marriage, was kind of a shotgun affair, because in your one-night, one-week stand, Sharon gets pregnant. And you guys decide, actually, to get married. I mean, that's not normal. How does that happen?
Well, I mean, they decide to make the best of a terrible situation. And I think, like, in that very, very first episode, you can see that it's more than just a one-week stand. You know, they sort of declare a couple of things to each other when the Rob character is flying back. You know, that makes you sort of, you can tell that they've left a sort of mark on each other. And I guess the question is that would they have got back together if she hadn't been pregnant? I don't know. Would they have seen each other again? I don't know. But, you know, it does happen. I guess the thing was they were at a certain time in their life. Well, she was anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they weren't 22.
Yeah.
So
those decisions kind of have more import. And
yeah.
I think you tell me in the pilot of the episode that you're like, what age are you? When I'm I don't know if I'm going to keep the baby. He's like, well, you know, look at the old clock there. So it's sort of a needs must kind of thing. But underneath it all, they definitely really liked each other.
And in the show, obviously, Rob, you moved to London. And in reality, for making this show, you moved your family to London. What was that like for you?
I mean, the first couple of years are a blur, honestly, because we were working so hard on the show. And also, we thought that we were only going to move there for 6 months and then the show would be canceled. So we literally put all our stuff in L.A. in storage. And my wife took a leave of absence from her teaching job. And we were like, dude, stay right where you are. We'll be right back. And now it's coming up on 5 years. Catastrophe has ended, and we still live there. And it's great. I mean, the UK is wonderful. You've got the NHS. There's no guns. You know, you can take a double-decker bus. So it's UK's a great place to live, and we're pretty happy there.
Yeah, NHS being the National Health Service, which everybody here is very relieved to have. I'm going to get to that in a moment because I know it played a very, very important role in your personal life, Rob, in your family life. But Sharon, I just want to ask you as well, because somewhat similar, not exactly similar, but I think that in your own personal life, you and your husband, well, you weren't married at the time, right? You got pregnant and decided to get married.
Yes, that is what happened. I mean, you know, I'm from a Catholic, Irish Catholic family. So the getting married thing was kind of, I mean, even though I was of a certain age at the time, it was still, you know, it was still best that I got married once I found out I was pregnant. We use the scene in the show where we tell my parents that I'm getting married. And then my dad says, oh, I thought you were going to say you were pregnant for a minute. I go, yeah, that as well. That's also part of this. It's exactly what happened. I mean, it was longer. It wasn't a 6-night stand. It was a 6-month stand. Mm-hmm. So there was a bit more of a, there was something more there. But yeah, it was the same deal. I was kind of, what else was I going to do? I guess at that point in my life, I thought, well, I'll dive in.
Do you think
what happens? And then we sort of speed lifed.
Yeah, life imitating art and art imitating life. I mean, it really is amazing how it's so connected to so many people. And there are a lot of people, even, you know, within my workplace who are thrilled that we're talking to you today because you've really reached out and grabbed so many people. What do you hear, Rob and Sharon, from people who write to you about this? What are the biggest messages that they tell you about what they're getting from this?
I mean, a big one is people ask us if we're secretly filming them in their homes and using their lives as fodder for the show. Another big one that we really love to get is couples that watch it together. There are people who say, you know, oh, this is the only show my husband and I or my wife and I watch together. And that is a wonderful feeling to have something that people can enjoy together. Yeah, we're proud of that.
I think it's that they feel like whatever representation we put on screen makes them feel less like monsters, you know, like hearing those sort of things said out loud, how difficult it is or how much you might hate your partner at certain points or how you just want to get away from your baby, you know, how you want to go back to work so that you can have some peace. Like all those things sort of said out loud make people feel a little bit less awful.
Yeah.
And I think that helps.
And maybe give people permission to feel in all these ways that inevitably happen in couples and relationships.
Yeah. And in other sort of aspects as well. I mean, there's an episode where I lose my dad, but I don't have the kind of correct emotional response, and you know I don't cry and I don't mourn him, and I had, you know, one of the mums at my school come up to me and say that she felt exactly the same. I mean, it, you know, the tears came eventually, but it just made her feel less sort of alone in that, you know, awful feeling that she wasn't doing it right, you know.
And Rob, there's another clip that we're going to play because it really centers around you, because it's not all light and fun. There's also dark moments. And you in the show are an alcoholic. You've had, you know, many episodes getting drunk. You had a car accident and you've been to rehab. And here you are and Sharon talking about it.
How did you know I was in Dalston?
Find my phone.
What?
The app thing.
You need to stop surveilling me, okay? I'm not planning a bank robbery. I'm going to AA. I'm working in a charity shop, plus my real job. And I'm doing the best I can. And you're just, I mean, it's like making a murderer up in here. Are you trying to drive me back to the bottle?
Oh my God. Now I've heard it all. Does that make you feel good, blaming it on me?
It feels great.
Those are for Frankie's lunch.
Really? Did he pay for them? Or did I?
again, it's just, it really, there's so much in the world today about addiction and alcoholism and depression and all the dark side of life that inevitably people, many people live with and don't quite know how to, in many cases, express or get help for. I think that whole part of you, Rob, and the way you relate to Sharon in this program is probably very helpful to a lot of people who may be in the same situation.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we do our best. We really do try to, if the facts of the show catastrophe are not real, we at least want all the feelings to be. And life is funny, and life is difficult and painful. And so we do try to not shy away from any sort of corner of the human and relationship experience. So yeah, I mean, of course, we then sprinkle it with no shortage of jokes, but we really do try to keep it real wherever and however we can.
So it brings me to obviously what's happened in your family. You lost your young son to cancer, to a tumor, and after he died, you came back to work. I mean, here you are working with Sharon on the final season as you are mourning and grieving. And you've talked a lot about it. And I just wonder what it was, you know, did that help you? Was that part of the process? What was it like?
I mean, so my son Henry died now 15 months ago. So that's really like the blink of an eye, you know? And when I first started writing the fourth season with Sharon, I'll be honest, I did it because, not because I cared if a fourth season of the show existed, but because I wanted my kids and my wife, my surviving kids, and my wife to just see me go to work to sort of show some sort of semblance of normalcy. So I started working, you know, just a couple days a week at first and really not caring what came out, you know. And then over time, I began to enjoy the process. And then when we were really humming and, you know, polishing scripts and stuff, by then I was enjoying it. And that didn't mean that I didn't grieve. It didn't mean that I didn't cry at my desk or have to leave sometimes and just go lie down because grief is so exhausting, you know? So the show itself, I wouldn't say was therapeutic for me, but sort of going through the motions and working on something intensely, I don't know, did offer some sort of structure or scaffolding to my life that allowed me to grieve, you know, and have the grief move through me as it continues to do. So I'm glad I did it. I'm very surprised that I began to truly enjoy it. And I'm in still shock that we produced a season that we're very proud of. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a... Yeah. I don't remember what your question was, but no, I spoke for a couple minutes.
Yeah, no, it was that. And I just wonder, Sharon, I see you, you know, looking at this man who's your friend and your collaborator. You know, how did you react also? Because you're sitting with him writing and you're watching this grief unfold as well.
I was just... in, you know, in awe of him every day, you know, that he was there. It's difficult for me to talk about, but it you know, because it was, you know, not my tragedy, but I you know, I was just there for him if he needed me. Sometimes he did, sometimes he didn't, you know, like Rob was saying, sometimes he just needed to cry and oftentimes you run out of the right thing to say because you can't say anything right because nothing you can say is ever right. But yeah, every day I was just amazed by him and I don't know how he did it and I never will, but yeah.
Again, I think your story is well known, especially to the people who love this show, and it'll mean a huge amount to people, you know, knowing what you've gone through and how you've gone through it. And I just wonder, and certainly I'm sure a lot of your fans wonder, this is the final season on television. But will there be more of catastrophe? Will there be a film? Will there be more seasons at some point, more series, do you think?
Well, we don't have anything planned right now. I think to date, and we reserve the right to change our minds, but I am proud of us for getting to the point where we were like, I don't know that I have anything else to say on this topic, and then, like, putting a pin in it, you know, because there's pressure to do more. Yeah. But we don't want to make any bad ones, you know?
And also, we were delighted with how we ended it.
Yeah, we did. We are very happy.
You know, it sort of turned out exactly the way we had it in our heads. And, you know, I think for us, we loved writing together, and it was something that was very easy to do together. And it's not usually easy. And so, you know, I think we hope at some point down the line we'll do that again.
Yeah.
But for now, I think these characters are going to sleep for a little while anyway.
Well, we'll miss them.
Like the end of Ferris Bueller. And Matthew Broderick comes out and he goes, what are you still doing here? Go. So to all the people who are like, make a season 5, we're like, oh, just go get pregnant. Go travel the world. Go live your own life.
Well, we'll miss them. Rob Delaney, Sharon Horgan, thank you so much indeed for joining me. We turn now to a film that tackles issues plaguing America's small towns. Shining a spotlight on healthcare and housing, Little Woods follows two adopted sisters in North Dakota whose troubles are tangled up in poverty. It's played by rising stars Lily James and Tessa Thompson. The film was created by the first-time director and writer Nia DaCosta, and she spoke to our Alicia Menendez about what she was aiming for.
Nia, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I loved this film. Congratulations. What led you to this?
Well, you know, it's kind of a weird roundabout story, but I was living in London getting my master's after graduating Tisch at NYU, and I had this weird sense of, like, homesickness.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be this sort of weird Americana sense of, like, American culture that I really missed. And then I sort of had to interrogate that. Like, what exactly am I talking about when I say, like, America, Americana? Like, what does that mean for me as a woman of color, a New Yorker? And so as I was trying to, like, figure this out, I watched, like, Winter's Bone and Country Strong, and I was, like, sorting through, like, what a movie like that would look like with a black protagonist, with two women living in a rural part of America.
You'd never been to North Dakota?
No, never. I didn't really know it was going to be set in North Dakota initially. I had been researching, like, just rural parts of America. Like, where do I want this to be set? Where is the best place to tell my story? I knew it was going to be about healthcare. I knew there'd be an abortion in the story. I knew I wanted to talk about how women in particular experience poverty, like how it can be a gendered experience. And then while I was trying to find the place in America that was the most difficult to access an abortion, I found this little part of northwest North Dakota, and inside of it, the town Williston. And Williston was going through a massive oil boom at the time. While researching that part of the country, I realized what was happening in these oil boom towns and how it's been not only like redrawing the oil map of the world, but also changing the way these people live. So like male to women ratio would be 2-1, for example. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that I was like, oh, wow, that's insane. And also a really great place to tell a story about how women experience poverty, how they have to access healthcare, all these things, how different it is from men if they're living in a place like that.
I want to take a look at a clip from the film. This is Tessa Thompson, who mm-hmm. plays your protagonist, Ollie. Yeah. She's in the past been a drug runner. She is now reformed. She's mm-hmm. on the brink of getting a new job, which yeah. is going to lead her to a new life. And in the middle of the job interview, her past shows up. Let's take yeah. a look.
So, Ollie, your probation officer, Officer
Carter
has told me so many things about you, and I think it goes without saying that he must see a lot in you if he's willing to vouch for you.
You know what? Will you just excuse me? I have to go to the bathroom.
Oh,
sorry.
Of course. What? What? Okay, about what? I'm busy.
Little Birdie told me.
F*** your little birdie, Bill. What do you want?
I want a cut.
What?
I know you're selling again. And I don't appreciate losing customers because you decided to get back in the business. So I'll make you a deal. You give me a cut, I don't get greedy, and I don't get angry.
Now, I don't know who told you, but I'm...
I'm making this real simple for you, King. You keep selling, you give me 30%. Or you do what you do best and make a run across the border for me. I'll even pay you. That's only fair. Choose.
Ollie has gotten back to drug running because her sister is pregnant. Their mother's house is in foreclosure. And you have a line in the script that I love. Your choices are only as good as your options are. These are characters with no good options.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a lot of what I want to talk about, which was what drew me initially to telling the story was I cared a lot about these issues, but the way that they were covered was so political and so from a distance point of view from anyone's actual lived experience. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the time we view people who are poor or who make decisions we don't agree with as having some kind of moral character failure, when really it's just people do what they can with the resources they're given. In particular, the characters in this film, the resources they're given aren't great, and but their needs are great. And so their choices are really only as good as what they have around them, as good as their options. And so I really wanted that to be the crux of the story.
How much... over the whole pregnancy, I mean, you know, bare minimum. How much is that?
Depends on your insurance. Your copay could be as little as 10, 20 a visit.
Yeah, or what if I lost my insurance?
No reimbursement. But if you do it right, you can get 12 prenatal visits and some prenatal vitamins. So pregnancy and birth is going to be about 8 or 9,000. And if you need a cesarean, 12.
Being pregnant costs $8,000?
I'm afraid so, honey.
You're a person, though, of relative privilege. I mean, you grew up in a city. You went to boarding school. Mm-hmm. You went to an elite institution for a college. What was your access point for talking about this type of challenge?
It was acknowledging and realizing that. Because I grew up, I would say, poor. My mom would hate me saying that, but I didn't grow up with a lot. And occasionally, you know, I would feel the struggle. Like, my mom kept a lot of that away from me because she's a wonderful mother in person. But, you know, like, I went to private school for most of my life, but that wasn't because it was easy. It's because I got, like, 99% scholarships. Right. And also my mother would be paying off my middle school when I was in high school, and high school when I was in college. And I still have, like, six figures of student loans that I'll pay off one day, maybe. But at the same time, I live in New York City, a pretty progressive place. I have access to a lot of resources. If I get sick, I can literally walk to a hospital from my house. I can take the train to a Planned Parenthood if I need to get an IUD or get a checkup or anything. And if I don't have insurance, which I didn't have for a very long time after college, usually there's a way to figure out what to do. And that's because of where I live and the legislation that's in place and the organizations that exist here. And so when I realized, oh, actually, like, I have so much that I at my fingertips. And women in a similar situation to me living in places like this do not have those resources. And if they have those resources, they don't have the information or the ability to access them. So that, for me, was really what pushed me towards telling the story, realizing my relative privilege and wanting to explore that.
I want to look at another clip that comes pretty early in the film where you have the sisters visiting their mortgage broker to try to persuade him to sell them back their house. Let's take a look.
It's been a rough time for a lot of people.
Yeah. And here we are trying to keep the one thing that we have that nobody else is going to want. Trust me, if you sell the house, you'd pay us to keep it. Can you let us just give you half the money? Please.
I'll see what I can do.
I hate begging. Mia, it doesn't exactly float my boat either, but $3,000 would be better than six.
Might as well be 50,000. Money's money is money when you ain't got it.
If you can get us half the total mortgage in 1 week, we can redistribute the rest across future payments.
That's great. Yeah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You deal with the economic downturn, the housing crisis, the opioid crisis, access to reproductive care, and yet the film doesn't end up feeling like explicit commentary on any of those things. How did you thread that needle?
Oof, I don't know if I tried to do that purposely. I knew I definitely didn't want to have like a political like statement that I was making like inside of the film. I didn't want to take away from the human stories, like, from the characters, what they're going through, that relationship. But when I was looking at Williston in particular and other Wilbraham towns in that area, and also looking at deindustrialized towns, all these things just coexist. Like, everything affects each other. It's like an ecosystem. And so it wouldn't have been honest if I just talked about, like, abortion, or if I just talked about the oil boom, or if I just talked about housing. And there's a version of the movie that just isolates that one thing, and it's just a movie about one woman's journey to try to go to Canada to get an abortion. But I realized there's just so much to tell, and so I wanted to be honest about how dynamic and complex it is.
The other thing I noticed watching that clip is that you have sisters, mm-hmm. one adopted, mm-hmm. Which allows you to place a black character mm-hmm. in this landscape, yeah. which you said was something you knew you wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So how did you arrive at that as the mechanism for having Tessa in the...
Well, they're both adopted, actually. How did I arrive at that? Well, I knew I wanted a black lead. And I think part of my experience being in some private schools is being the only black person.
Yes.
Being in really white area, so I am familiar with that feeling and what that's like. Unlike private school, I was also surrounded by like rich white people, so that's like a whole other thing. But I know what that's like, and I think that's an interesting dynamic. And then I'm really into the concept of like the family you choose. I think that's been a big theme in my life, not just with my friends, but also within my family. Like, you know, I have aunts who I'm not actually related to, but you know, family you choose. Mm-hmm. You choose to take care of people. So that was just something I thought would be really important. And, yeah, I like having women of color, especially black women, at the center of my stories. So that was kind of an inevitable.
This film is a blending of genres. You call it part Western, part thriller. When you were in the room and you were pitching it to people, did people get it?
Yes, thankfully. And it's because I had roadmaps like Winter's Bone and Frozen River to throw at them and say, look at these films. These work. These were about women. They're about a rural part of America. It's about their struggles. It's about them doing things that weren't great, but things they had to do because of the lives they led. And it was so good at blending drama. You know, so I got to use those two examples. And I love those movies, which is really great. So that was useful. But at the same time, the only people who said yes to this movie were the people who said yes, in a way, you know? It's like, people were like, wow, love it, great, very sad, very drama, very, you know, very difficult. And I was like, I know, but... So, of all the people I talked to, like, maybe, probably not hundreds, but, like, sometimes I think it's over 100, only, like, 6 or 7 said yes, you know, so...
And yet neither of the films you just referenced have a black female lead.
No, yeah.
And so how did that further complicate those conversations?
Oh, I mean, you know, interestingly, I think it's an interesting balance of by the time I was pitching to a certain number of investors, Tessa Thompson had been in Creed. She just had done Dear White People. So people were, like, really excited about her. But before she was involved, the black lead definitely was like, oh, well, you know, like, and it wouldn't be, I mean, you're not really allowed to talk about it in that way, but it was definitely a part of the conversation in sort of coded ways. But because of who Tessa is, it was, that actually made it a bit easier.
You have said that you write and love complicated women mm-hmm. with agency. Why do we not see more of that in film?
Ooh, I think, honestly, like, on a social level, we don't really enjoy complicated women with agency.
In real life,
yeah. And I think also... In Hollywood, I mean, if you actually just look at the beginning of Hollywood, it's actually insane. And, like, I know we're supposed to be, like, this liberal area, but really it's really not that progressive. So now people are really starting to realize, like, actually, like, complicated women with agency are, like, interesting. And, like, everyone wants to watch them. Like, Captain Marvel just came out. And, yes, that's a Marvel film, but it's, like, the second highest grossing one so far.
Among your next projects is the remake of Candyman, classic horror film.
Sequel. Yeah. Spiritual sequel. Yeah.
With Jordan Peele producing. Why that?
Oh, my gosh. Why not that? How could I say no? So Candyman, when I was growing up, like when I was younger, was so part of the fabric of the cultural fear. Sort of in the same vein as, like, Bloody Mary, because, you know, you say his name 5 times in the mirror, he comes, he cuts you, and you die. And I love horror films. I love genre films and horror in particular. And being able to take, to do a story like that with, that's about black people in a way. I mean, the first film is a bit complicated. We can talk about that. But it's about, set in a black community. It's about black people. It's about stories, about black stories and history and the horror of it and the injustice of it in ways. But it's told in this horror context, which I think is really interesting. And then on top of that, like, Jordan Peele, I think, is just an amazing brain. He's wonderful, wonderful human. And, you know, I loved Get Out, and it just made sense. It was this really, it's, like, truly, like, an honor to be directing that film. And it's kind of exactly what I wanted to do next, which was to do something bigger, to do something with a larger scope, and to do something in a genre space.
Because you want to do it all.
Yes, I do. Yeah. I want to keep scaling up. I want to make bigger and bigger projects, but also be able to go back and do smaller things. But always at the center of those stories being women, in particular women of color, women with agency who are complex and dynamic and unconventional.
No small feat. Nia, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was so great.
Nia DaCosta on Women There, pursuing those important stories and bigger projects. And that's it for our program tonight. Thanks for watching. And remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at avanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.